You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a Wisconsin employer is trying to get new hires on board quickly. Their strategy, $8,000 year-end bonuses if you start by the end of the month. We'll talk to a regional economist about the labor supply here in Wisconsin. Now, earlier this week, the Wisconsin Natural Resources Board, which sets policy for the Department of Natural Resources, voted to approve going forward with a fall wolf hunt this year. And it set a quota of 300 wolves to be taken over the, that's well over the number that the DNR was proposing. DNR Secretary Preston Cole responded after the vote that NRB Chair Fred Preen had stayed in his position past the expiration of his term, specifically, he said, so that he could oversee the next wolf hunt. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Did you or someone you know testify at Wednesday's hearing? A lot of folks did. How does the wolf issue affect you where you live? What do you think about how all of this is being handled? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. Danielle Kading is a WPR reporter based in Superior. She reported on this meeting. Danny, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, thanks for having me on, Rob.
Well, can you talk us through the outcome of this meeting? What does this end up all meaning for a wolf hunt still this year?
Well, it means that there will be a 300 wolf quota for the fall hunt. And like you said, that was far above. It was actually double the DNR's harvest recommendation of 130 wolves. And that was a number they recommended because of uncertainty over how the wolf population was responding to the February wolf hunt, during which state licensed hunters killed 218 wolves in less than 72 hours. And there's been a lot of concern surrounding whether or not a sustainable wolf population could be maintained with a higher level of harvest. And so now with that 300 wolf quota, they are obligated to split that between state licensed hunters and the tribes. And the tribes are pretty unhappy with the board's decision. They have said that they are outraged over this move. They think it's clearly not based on science and that it violates their federal treaty rights.
On top of that drama, there was also some drama related to the makeup of the board itself. I want to listen to a clip from near the end of this meeting after the vote on the quota. Secretary Preston Cole, the DNR, with Preen responding, the board member, Fred Preen. Here's a listen.
You'll never know what Sandy Nass would have said. You never will know what her discussions and debate would have been. So, Doc,
Mr. Secretary, thank you for your editorial comment. What was the final vote on that last motion?
Final vote was 5-2.
I think it would have passed without me being present, Mr. Secretary. And I think I think you're out of line for commenting editorial about this. I am out of order.
Move to personal privilege.
Go ahead.
Personal privilege as we get back on the agenda, please.
Danny, can you explain what's going on with that Natural Resources Board member still in that chair, as Secretary Cole said?
Yeah, sure. So Natural Resources Board Chair Fred Preen has faced a lot of criticism and repeated calls to step down from multiple groups because his term expired on May 1st. And, you know, as has normally happened in the past, usually board members will step down at the end of their term and the appointee from the incoming governor will name somebody to the board. And that's what happened. Democratic Governor Tony Evers made two appointments to the board and to fill what he called the expiring or vacating terms of Preen and the board secretary, Julie Anderson, but only Julie Anderson stepped down. Preen has decided to stay on the board, and he said that a state Supreme Court ruling allows him to remain on the board until the Republican-controlled Senate confirms Evers' nominees. And as we've seen in the past with nominees made by the governor, the Republican-controlled Senate hasn't been in any hurry to take up those nominations and confirm appointees, and some high-level cabinet secretaries have waited years to be appointed.
Is there any movement that you know of to confirm this appointee of Governor Evers?
As far as I know, it's been referred to organizational committee in the Senate. My understanding is that it has not moved forward and there has been no confirmation hearing that has been set. So right now it looks like Prang could remain on the board indefinitely if the Republican-controlled Senate does not act.
So with this wolf hunt number now, the DNR made its proposal. The Natural Resources Board has approved a different number. Is that the end of the story now until this hunt actually happens, or are there more possible detours along the way?
Well, I think we're going to see a lot of pushback, particularly from tribes and environmental and wildlife groups. You know, there is still ongoing litigation where a lawsuit has been filed to restore protections for the gray wolf. And one of the presidents of the has said that he would like to see President Joe Biden and his administration look at that decision and relist the wolf. And so I think we're going to see a lot more effort to examine where the status of the wolf lies in the coming weeks ahead of the upcoming hunt in November.
Danny, thanks again for joining us.
Thanks, Rob.
That's Danielle Kading, WPR reporter based in Superior. We talked with her about the State Natural Resources Board meeting earlier this week that resulted in an approved quota of 300 wolves for a fall hunt this year. That'd be the second wolf hunt of 2021. Adrian Wideven joins us now for more about the wolf hunt. He's a wildlife biologist and wildlife working group co-chair for the conservation organization Wisconsin's Green Fire. Adrian is also a former wolf biologist for the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources and submitted testimony himself on Wednesday. Adrian, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
What was your reaction to this outcome, this 300 number target for the wolf hunt?
I was rather surprised and very displeased. We had thought within Green Fire that even a harvest of 130 was perhaps too high for conditions because of the high levels of uncertainty going into this hunting season, and 300 wolves would likely drastically reduce the wolf population. So I have a great deal of concern about that.
Now, Adrian, as I understand it, this 300 number, it'll actually be split. Some of that quota can be claimed by tribal groups who would then not use their part of the quota because they don't want any wolves hunted at all for the most part. So is the number actually substantially lower than that 300?
Well, if the tribes declare, I believe they can declare about 42%, so about 170 wolves would still be hunted this year. And that still is an excessive amount considering that the high levels of uncertainty that we're dealing with. This last winter, we have uncertainty because the population count was done in February. Normally, that's done in March, but because of the hunting season, it had to be completed more quickly. The hunt itself, the number of animals removed, we know that there are 218 animals that were registered, but the rapidness of the hunt, the methods of take, we suspect the illegal kill and unrecovered animals were probably substantial, so it probably was considerably higher than 218. And then there's quite a bit of uncertainty because the lack of breeding, the removal of breeding females, removing of breeding males, reducing the breeding potential of that population. So these high levels of uncertainty just make it very difficult to come up with a reasonable quota, and anything over more than a handful of wolves is really not justifiable.
If you were in charge of setting up a plan for a next wolf hunt, what would you want to see happen?
Well, if the department had the authority to say that we should not hold a hunt this year, that would probably be appropriate because of the high levels of uncertainty. Green Fire is recommending no more than 30 wolves for this next winter or next fall hunt.
We're talking about Wisconsin's wolf hunt. A second one for 2021 is scheduled for this fall. Adrian Wideven is with us, wildlife biologist and wildlife working group co-chair for the conservation organization Wisconsin's Green Fire. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about this new quota set by the state's Natural Resources Board? Does it sound reasonable to you or not? Did you comment at the meeting? If you didn't, what would you like to say to members of the Natural Resources Board? What questions do you have about wolf numbers here in Wisconsin? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with wildlife biologist Adrian Wideven, looking at the new quota of 300 wolves approved for a fall hunt this year, that by the Wisconsin Natural Resources Board this week. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of the idea of having a second hunt this year at all at the target number there? Are wolves an issue in your community? What do you think about this hunt this fall? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Adrian, supporters of this quota number or even higher numbers were pointing toward a state target to have about 350, I think was the number of wolves in the state. And they said, hey, if we're going to get down to that number, we need a decent-sized hunt this fall. What do you say to that argument?
Well, the 350 goal was based on population information from the 1990s when we developed our 1999 plan. And that was intended to be a threshold level when certain management activities, including lethal controls and hunting, could be considered. It was not intended to be a level to push the population back down to. And now that goal is 22 years old. It was also based on different ideas of what the carrying capacity was for Wisconsin. At the time, we thought the state could only hold about 500 wolves. More recent estimates suggest that the carrying capacity is around 1,240 some wolves. So we know the state can hold a lot more wolves than that. And we've been having about 1,000 wolves on the landscape in the last couple of years. To reduce the population to 350 would mean we'd have to remove wolves from probably about two-thirds of their range in Wisconsin.
It's Brianna Caller now at 800-642-1234. Ryan is with us in Nisida. Ryan, hi.
Hello.
What do you think?
Yeah, I think we should stick with the 300. We definitely need to take into consideration that the amount of deer impact that the wolves have had is just as uncertain as how many wolves were taken out or not taken out. You know, so I think that we need to decrease the wolf population. They are definitely having an impact.
Ryan, thanks a lot for that call. Adrian, this is something we hear from deer hunting groups and others, concerns that too many wolves equals too few deer. What are we seeing out there?
Well, and we have really no evidence of that, no scientific evidence that there's been a drastic reduction in the deer population. We're seeing deer population at healthy levels in central forest of Wisconsin and northern Wisconsin in areas where we've got record wolf populations or had record wolf populations. Now we probably have reduced those populations some already from this winter hunt, but we're not seeing the evidence of that.
Thanks a lot for the call, Ryan, at 800-642-1234. We'll go next to Marcus with us in Milwaukee. Marcus, hi.
Hi. So I'm really confused on this. The whole thing seems ludicrous to me. But given the climate pressures that we're facing across the entire planet between wildfires, possible mass extinctions, and whatever else, it's been shown after study that you need apex predators to maintain the health of ecosystems. I think given the current situation, I think having the most apex predators out there to maintain that ecosystem is the best because it pushes smaller predators to the fringes and then they go after other types of pests like rats, squirrels, chipmunks, whatever, by having the foxes push more to the edge because the wolves push other predators, and it changes the whole grazing pattern.
Marcus, thanks for the call. Adrian, can you talk about the wolf's role as an apex predator in our Wisconsin ecosystems?
Sure. Marcus makes a lot of good points, and we know that having a wolf population, that in areas where we've had wolf packs, we see a greater diversity of understory plants. We have less heavy browsing on trees and shrubs. We don't have chronic wasting disease spreading through those areas. There's a recent study suggesting that even vehicle collisions on highways have been reduced in areas because of the presence of wolf populations. So we're seeing a wide variety of ecological and economical effects from a healthy wolf population. So certainly I would agree with a lot of the points that Marcus was making.
Marcus, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Russ joins us now in Wausau. Russ, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to bring up, Russ?
I was wondering about whether or not wolves in Wisconsin are considered a keystone species. And now, keystone species are not necessarily predators, but in certain areas, they may be. And they are very important to the survival of plant life and other species.
Russ, thanks a lot for the call. Adrian, that's kind of following up on Marcus's point. Do we define wolves as a keystone species?
I think a lot of people do because they do have these broad ecological impacts. I think one of the key keystone species in the state are probably beaver because they really alter their ecosystems. But wolves are also have an important role in just the things we talked about, their impact on the vegetation, their impact. They do have an impact on the deer herd. They move it around. They cull weak animals from the population. They reduce diseased animals in the population. So they have many beneficial impacts on the ecosystem.
Thanks a lot for that call, Russ. We're talking to Adrian Weideman, formerly a wolf biologist for the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, now a biologist with Wisconsin's Green Fire, a conservation organization looking at wolf hunts in Wisconsin, a new target set, 300 by the state's Natural Resources Board for the second hunt of this year scheduled for this fall. Let's go back to your calls now on that topic at 800-642-1234. Gina is on the line in Toma. Gina, hello.
Hello.
Well, what did you want to bring up, Gina?
From Toma, Wisconsin. Sure. First of all, I would like to thank Adrian for all of his work that he's done on the wolf hunt. I support a zero quota for the Wisconsin wolf hunt. I actually think our wolves should go back on the endangered species list. We need an apex hunter. I strongly oppose the methods of hunting that were utilized this February, hounding 24/7. The use of snowmobiles, trapping, snaring, pretty forms of barbaric hunting, in my opinion. And I believe truly in the state of Wisconsin, most of our hunters are ethical, and I believe this is an unethical form of hunting.
Gina, thanks a lot for the call. To Gina's first point, Adrian, the idea of putting gray wolves back on the endangered species list, this has been a back and forth for years now.
There has been, and our group, Green Fire, does support the delisting and state management of wolves, but we do have a great deal of concern over the current wolf management system in Wisconsin. We would like to see changes in the wolf hunting regulations, which will take legislative changes to grant more of the authority to the department so that in a situation like this year where we have all these levels of unknown, the department would have the opportunity to say, we're just not going to have a wolf hunting season this year. The state of Minnesota that has 2.5 times as many wolves as Wisconsin has decided to hold off wolf hunting season this fall until they have a new plan in place to determine the direction they want their wolf population to go. Michigan is not planning a wolf hunting season this next fall. Some years ago, in 1985, the Wisconsin DNR shut down the bear hunting season when it looked like the population was going to fall below 5,000 bears, and the state DNR felt it didn't have adequate control on the harvest, and that year it was determined it was best just to close the season. And unfortunately, the department doesn't have that kind of authority right now because that would probably be the appropriate move right now.
Thanks for the call, Gina. Gordon joins us now in Crandon. Gordon, hi.
Hello, are you there?
Yep, I hear you loud and clear, Gordon. What did you want to bring up?
Well, I'm a 74-year-old deer hunter from northern Wisconsin, northern Forest County here, and I'm here to tell you that we are getting eaten out of house and home by these wolves. I'm not going to buy a Wisconsin deer hunting tag this year because for the past 5 or 6 or even 10 years, it's literally impossible to kill a buck deer or any kind of a deer in the areas that I hunt. We have too many wolves. Now, some years ago, I was in Alaska on a vacation, my wife and I picked up the hunting regulation for the state of Alaska. And in that state, this was in 2005. At that time, there was 4 different areas in Alaska that you could kill, now get this, 10 a day, 9 months out of the year. So if you were a really good wolf hunter, you could kill, I figured, like 4,500 wolves or something. No license required. Anybody could do it. So I'm here to tell you that a bunch of us people up here are sick of these wolves, and people don't have any compassion for the deer or anything else that they live on. And this BS story that they only eat the sick and the old, that is not true.
Gordon, thanks for the call. Adrian?
Well, there's a lot there. Certainly there are areas that have a lower deer numbers, and wolves might be a factor, but there's a lot of other factors. Crandon, the area, also has a very lot of mature forest, and as the forest matures, there's less habitat for deer, so you have declining habitat for deer. We've had deer at too high in numbers in recent years, which has reduced carrying capacity of the landscape itself for deer by holding too many deer on the landscape. So wolves are might be a factor there, but there's certainly a lot of other things going on that would be reducing the deer numbers in the Crandon area.
Thanks a lot for that call, Adrian. In our last couple minutes, do you think that this quota could be changed between now and the fall hunt, or is this just a done deal now?
At this point, I guess that's more of a legalistic question, and I'm not sure about that on the authority of the department versus the Natural Resource Board, but certainly the tribes will request part of the 300, so I suspect at least it's going to be reduced from the 300, and to what extent the tribes are going to be able to remove animals from the harvest, we don't know yet, but perhaps as many as 130-some wolves that wouldn't be harvested, so down to about 170 as a harvest, which would be not as severe, but still more of a harvest than we need currently.
And you mentioned that our census, in effect, of wolves was interrupted by the hunt earlier this year. When are you hoping to see solid new numbers on Wisconsin's wolf population?
Well, typically the surveys occur from early part of December until the middle of March, and so we expect that probably be about April or May before those results would be tabulated, but sometime next spring when we would have a better idea of what the overwinter wolf population is.
Adrian, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks for having us, Rob.
Adrian Weidevin is a wildlife biologist and wildlife working group co-chair for the conservation organization Wisconsin's Green Fire. We talked to him, as well as WPR reporter Danielle Kading, about the State Natural Resources Board approving a quota of 300 for a fall wolf hunt this year. That would be the second wolf hunt of 2021. Coming up, a lot of employers say they're having a hard time finding workers this year. We'll find out what that means for jobs and the economy here in Wisconsin. And you can share your story if you're looking to hire people or to get hired yourself. What are you seeing out there? Email now, ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Or tweet us at Central Time WPR. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, the Senate signs off on a big bipartisan infrastructure deal. Andrew Cuomo quits, but the fallout from his resignation continues. And Jeopardy fans have their own questions about the show's new hosts. Jen White gets to all of it on the Friday News Roundup. That's today at 6 on 1A+. Now, many businesses in Wisconsin and across the country say they can't find enough workers to fill open jobs. In a June survey from Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce, 86% of businesses surveyed said that they were struggling to hire workers. That's meant many of them are raising pay and adding hiring incentives. Take, for example, the Pleasant Prairie packaging giant Uline. They've increased their year-end bonus for employees who are on board by the end of this month to $8,000. That's up $2,000 since just under a year ago. We're taking a look at the labor supply in Wisconsin and how it's impacting workers and employers in the state. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you looking to hire people? How's it going? Having trouble finding people to do the job? Are you getting into the workforce, back into the workforce? Are you holding out for one reason or another? Are you looking to switch from one type of career to another? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Steve Deller is a regional economist at UW-Madison. Steve, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
How hard is it for businesses in Wisconsin to find workers lately?
I think that we're returning to pre-pandemic where a lot of businesses were struggling with finding quality workers. I think that as we're trying to get back from the pandemic, I think those labor shortages that we were experiencing before the pandemic are just kind of, we've got a bit of a spotlight on them right now because there's some other complicating things here that are making a tight labor market even tighter.
Yeah, what are those complicating factors?
I think a lot of it is that some folks don't feel safe going back to work. There's still that kind of fear about the safety particularly now that we're going into this fourth wave of COVID now, not so much in Wisconsin, but in the southern states, you're seeing this fourth wave spike up a lot. That's making a lot of folks really nervous. And some people are hesitant, particularly for the businesses that are really experiencing this shortage, tend to be kind of lower paying jobs, jobs with minimal skill requirements. Those are the types of jobs that, you know, people are just really hesitant to go back to.
Some employers, including many in that Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce survey, point toward this enhanced unemployment benefit for workers scheduled to expire early next month. Is that a factor in keeping people on the sidelines if they're already unemployed, getting that little bit extra money?
I think for a very small percentage, that's probably true. That they are kind of saying, let's just sit and wait. You start adding in things like exposure to the virus, things like childcare, access to childcare, and then that little bit of additional money, you might see a small percentage that are still kind of in a wait and see mode. I think when that additional benefit goes away, you'll see a marginal increase in the labor force participation rate, but not enough of an increase to really alleviate the shortages that we have now.
As you mentioned, this isn't just a pandemic story. What fundamentals are out there that's creating, in some ways, a worker shortage here in the state?
Two things, I think. One is we simply have more jobs than we have people to fill those jobs. Wisconsin has historically had a very high labor force participation rate. So it's not that we have a lot of people sitting on the sidelines. You know, with the pandemic right now, we do have some people sitting on the sidelines for a variety of reasons. But we have, in essence, we have more jobs than we have people to fill those jobs. And when you start to get into lower paying type of jobs, that problem is exacerbated. So what we have really is not a labor force participation rate problem, is that we just simply don't have enough people moving into the state to take these jobs.
Well, we've got some new census numbers out, Steve. The state's population grew, not like gangbusters. Some parts grew, others went down. When you see these numbers, are we seeing enough people coming into the state and few enough leaving the state, I guess, to help solve that problem demographically?
No, I think we're not. We're not seeing enough people moving into the state. There's been a fair amount of work on this notion of the brain drain of that, you know, students that are going to the UW, for example, they're all flooding the state. That's not necessarily true. Where we're experiencing a brain disconnect is people with higher education or people with some college moving into the state. We're not getting people moving into the state as we would hope.
Talking to Steve Dollar, regional economist at UW-Madison, looking at the labor supply in the state, concerns about a worker shortage in many businesses. You can join in with your thoughts, questions, maybe your personal experience at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Penelope is with us in Dane County. Penelope, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to tell us about, Penelope?
Well, so I understand that, you know, on the one hand, Dane County's population has increased by 15%. I also understand that the minimum wage for the county, for the state, is not up to snuff. I mean, what's up, Dane County? I work for a nonprofit here in Dane County, and they can't raise their entry-level hourly rate higher than $12. And how is that a livable wage here in Dane County when the average cost of a house is $400,000? So let's see, how many people do you have to have live in that house in order to be able to afford it?
Penelope,
maybe eight?
Penelope, thanks a lot for the call. Steve, what are we seeing with wages given this shortage of labor supply?
Well, you've got the public sector and the private sector, and the private sector has greater flexibility in how they can raise wages and whatnot. In the public sector, it's a little bit more difficult because there are rules and regulations that have to be adjusted. In terms of the nonprofits, a lot of times they would, and this is true for a lot of businesses, they would like to increase their wages. They simply cannot increase their wages. Now, one of the things that's going to shake out, I think, is that a lot of marginal businesses that really can't afford to pay a little bit more, they're going to kind of be pushed to the side over the long term. They're either going to have to adapt to having fewer workers, which means maybe automation, or they're going to have to find a different way of conducting business, or they may simply decide that this business is no longer viable. We did through the pandemic, we lost a lot of those businesses. They're gone. They're not coming back. But this labor shortage and the increase in wages may push a few more of those out the door. Now, the question is that, we're losing jobs to pay $10 an hour, $11 an hour. Is that really a bad thing?
Penelope, thanks for the call. Penelope also brings up a mismatch. And Dane County, certainly there are other places in the state you could point to where the wages are what they are, $12 an hour at her work, and cost of living, housing costs are really high, historically high in a lot of places in the state. How big a problem is that to, I mean, if you want to bring in new workers, they got to have a place to live.
That is one of the issues. When I work around Wisconsin communities, there's a couple of issues that they're just uniformly communities are struggling with: broadband, labor shortages, and housing. And housing is either too expensive for the types of jobs that are in the community, or it's substandard housing. People don't want to live there. So what we're finding, and this is some work that a colleague of mine, Matt Kiris, has been doing, is looking at what's called stretch commuting. People that commute more than 50 miles one way to go to work. And over the last 15, 16, 17 years, that number has just kind of exploded. And I think my hypothesis is, we haven't done the research yet, but I think a big factor in what's driving that is relative housing costs. So I may have a job in, say, an urban center like, say, a Madison, but I can't afford to live in Madison. So what I'll do is I will now start to decide to commute. The other thing that's going to complicate this, and this is we're having a really hard time getting a handle on this, is telecommuting. The pandemic proved that a lot of occupations can be undertaken by telecommuting. Are we going to see kind of this movement out into more rural communities, smaller communities, to take advantage of a different lifestyle, lower housing costs, and telecommute? That's still playing itself out, and we don't really know exactly how that's going to play out.
Penelope, thanks for that call. We'll go to Sarah now in Minocqua. Sarah, hi.
Hi. I just wonder, I think that there are kind of two groups of people. There are certainly a lot of people who don't have a choice. They have to go out and work. They have absolutely no cushion, financial cushion, and so they are going to work no matter what. And then there's a group of people like myself who maybe don't have to work, have a financial cushion. I'm not on any public assistance, but, I've always been underemployed, and I feel like now would be a perfect time for me to go out and level up and pretty much ask for my salary. But I think that the first group of people, the people who have to, who are going to work no matter what, a lot of those people are the people who are not getting vaccinated. And so I have a disincentive to go and work for a place where my coworkers are going to be unvaccinated. I'm not going to jeopardize my safety for that, even though I am vaccinated. Now, I know people that are desperately looking to hire people, and they have a fleet of workers who refuse to get vaccinated, and they call the shots. I mean, they don't have to show up for work. They're able to get paid whatever, they ask for. They pretty much know they've got the employer over a barrel, and they're not able to attract people who are vaccinated into that situation.
Interesting. Sarah, what do you think, Steve, of the scenario Sarah's painting there?
I think that's true, and I think that this is why there's a hesitation for folks that are, that don't have to work. That first group that Sarah was talking about is, I don't have a choice. I have to go to work. That could be a single parent. It could be a single person. It could be, a variety of situations where they don't have a choice. They have to work. And But with the labor market the way it is right now, is that if their employer, for example, is not mandating vaccination, and they don't feel safe, there are now's the time to shift careers and shift employment. And I think that this is where a lot of folks are starting to think about, is this the kind of work that I want to continue to do? Now, if I'm going to shift, now is the time to do that. I also think we're going to start to see a lot more firms mandating vaccination, simply because of what Sarah mentioned, is that some people simply will not work in an environment where they don't feel safe. And the current fourth wave is exacerbating that. So if we had this conversation 2 weeks ago before the fourth wave hit, we'd be talking one way. But it's such a dynamic situation that it's really kind of hard to say, you know, this is exactly what's happening, because the condition keeps changing.
Sarah, thanks for that call. We're talking to Steve Deller, regional economist at UW-Madison, talking to him about a worker shortage in much of Wisconsin. You can join in with your thoughts, your experiences, your questions at 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our discussion about concerns about worker shortages in Wisconsin and how it's impacting different industries, businesses, and employees and employers in Wisconsin. Steve Deller stays with us from UW-Madison. Let's go back to your calls now. Jeff is with us in Waukesha. Jeff, hi.
Hello, Jeff. Thanks for letting me on. The only thing I wanted to mention was how employers treat their employees. I was reading the Reader's Digest that Amazon drivers don't even have enough time to go to the bathroom and even get a lunch break. I mean, things like that, creating an environment that is makes the employee, their day go easier for them, would go a long way along with the wages. But I think that's another aspect that we never talk about.
Interesting point, Jeff. Thanks for bringing that up, Steve. Not necessarily just about wages, but the working conditions that Jeff's thinking about there.
I think Jeff's point is right on target. There are a lot of businesses that are going to continue to have labor shortage issues because nobody wants to work for them. Businesses that treat their employees as their most valuable asset and are willing to work with those employers, perhaps in a non-monetary way. We would like to give you a raise. We can't, but what can we do to make your work environment more pleasant? The more that those kind of businesses can do that, I think that those businesses are going to have a leg up. And I think Jeff's point is extremely well taken, particularly when you have a labor shortage. If you're looking at a job that's paying $12 an hour and it's not a very pleasant place to work, and there's another business across the street that's paying $12.25 an hour, and it's a really nice place to work at, guess what? You're going to see employees flooding over to that other business. They may even drop down from $12 an hour to $11.50 an hour and take a little bit less money simply because it's a better work environment. I think Jeff's is exactly right.
Jeff, thanks for that call. We'll go to Dale now in Madison. Dale, hello.
Yeah, you mentioned that a lot of these shortages are on like front-end low-wage workers. A lot of those jobs are part-time because the employers do not want to pay health care. Well, it used to be that those people would work two or three part-time jobs, not have health care, but count on the extra income. Now in COVID, those people are saying, no, 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 I'll do one part-time job instead of three and have Medicaid. So I think that has to be taken into account. You used to have one person doing three jobs. Those people aren't going to make that choice anymore, because they need the health care. This country has to deal with health care if they want workers.
Dale, thanks for the call. Steve, health care being or lack of health care being a disincentive to work more.
Dale, again, just like Jeff, I think you're exactly right. I think that a lot of employers, you see this in the auto industry, is that you had a lot of labor unions basically say, look, we're willing to take lower pay if you maintain our health benefits. And if you are working for a company that says, hey, you know, we're paying you even $15 an hour, and say, you know, you have a choice, between an increase in pay and no health benefits, or keep that same pay and we're going to offer you basic health benefits, I would bet that the vast majority of the employees would take the health benefits, because healthcare is extremely expensive. And it's the major cause of personal bankruptcy in the U.S. So I think you're right. And that's where a lot of businesses have to start thinking outside the box. They have to start thinking, you know, what else can we do to make this position attractive to employees, and offering a better work environment, and offering, even if it's basic healthcare, those types of things are really very well received.
Thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to Steve Deller, economist at UW-Madison, about worker shortages in the state. Back to your calls now. Mike is on the line in Madison. Mike, hi.
Hi, Steve. Thanks for taking my call. I was wondering, I wanted to ask, you mentioned earlier that small businesses are kind of de-incentivized or disincentivized from raising their wages, and it would kind of snuff them out and push them off to the side. I was wondering how you think, or like what we could do to kind of level the playing field between small businesses and large corporations like Amazon, where workers can't even unionize. I kind of wanted to hear your thoughts on that.
Steve, what do you think?
I think the one thing that small businesses can do can go back to Jeff's earlier caller's comment about making this a really pleasant place to work. I've done some research with a colleague of mine, Tessa Conroy, that looked at the differences between women business owner and men business owners. And guess what? Women business owners tend to outperform men business owners. And part of it is this kind of non-monetary compensation. It's making it a better work environment. And I think that that's one thing that we could probably help work with small businesses, the owners and the management, in terms of how to be more effective in keeping their employees happy. Many of these small business owners are very, very good at what they do, but sometimes they struggle with the business end of it. And this type of kind of strategy could actually be quite helpful.
Thanks a lot for that call. Mike, I want to get in one more caller before we run out of time. Steve, Katie is with us in Spring Green. Katie, hi.
Hi. I'm just trying to comment on the low-wage restaurant work. I came from Chicago 6 years ago after spending 12 years cooking, where I worked for very little money, but I was always trying to get to a point where I'd either get to be a chef or a sous chef. I moved to Wisconsin and started a small food business. And out here in Spring Green, there was basically no labor pool. There's not even culinary classes or cooking classes at the high school. When I started, I was in high school, and I got to take a ton of cooking classes in my regular high school day. And like here, there's not even that. So I don't know where you're hoping to get the low-paid workers who want to learn a skill, because there aren't going to be jobs that pay them well, even if they advance in their career.
Katie, thanks for that call. Steve, your thoughts on what Katie had to say just in our last minute?
I think that's right, but I think you need to look beyond Spring Green for your labor pool. I think you need to start looking like all the way up to Baraboo, all the way down to Richland Center, and start looking at a much bigger pool to tap into. Tap into the Madison College Culinary Arts Program. It's an excellent program. So a lot of times people think, well, I'll just put an ad in the local newspaper. That's not sufficient. You got to look out broader. Also create an environment where people want to work there. I may not make a lot of money, but I really love what I'm doing and I love who I work for. So there are strategies that you can put in place, but it's a struggle.
Katie, good luck to you. And Steve, thanks as always for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's Steve Deller, regional economist at UW-Madison, with us today to talk about what a worker shortage looks like in Wisconsin and how it's affecting workers and employers. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show. Monday at 8, state lawmakers in Wisconsin and elsewhere are trying to limit certain lessons about race and history in schools, including ideas inspired by critical race theory. an expert on race and education, joins the show for a look at the best ways to talk about tough issues in American history. That's Monday at 8 on The Morning Show. Up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then a lot of people with Wisconsin ties were Olympians or Paralympians this year. We'll talk to a Wisconsin Olympic swimmer and a sports reporter about Wisconsinites in the Tokyo Games. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.